This material is made available to you by or on behalf of the University of Melbourne under Section 113P of the Copyright Act 1968. It may be subject to copyright. For more information, visit the University Copyright website.
Am I nice and loud? Oh, I am nice and loud. There we go. Okay. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Kristen Rundle, and with Professor Adrienne Stone, I'm a co-director of the Centre for Comparative Constitutional Studies here at Melbourne Law School. And under the CCS banner, I am delighted to be wearing that hat, but also wearing my hat as one of the teaching team for administrative law here at the law school, where one of our foundational studies in admin law is on the Office of the Ombudsman. And today we are very privileged to be able to be talking directly to the source. We have with us Michael Manthorpe, the current and 10th Commonwealth Ombudsman. Ombudsman Manthorpe was appointed to the role in May 2017, so coming up to 2 years of a five-year term. He is a career public servant with a background in journalism and history, so not a lawyer, although working every day with a lot of the questions and structures that we lawyers are involved in the design and administration of. Michael has worked across various functions within the Australian Public Service, including responsibility for visa design as Deputy Secretary of the Department of Immigration, and he's also been the recipient of the highest honour in the public service, the Public Service Medal for his services. Now, we are very fortunate that what we're going to do today is not a lecture, it's a conversation, and we're going to leave plenty of time for questions. But what we were hoping to do was to think about this institution of the Commonwealth Ombudsman at the point of its four decades and a little bit of its life. And it's particularly fitting given that Ombudsman Manthorpe is the 10th Ombudsman in that tenure of the office so far. We have three themes that we're going to be moving across. They're all closely interrelated. A little sense of how the journey of that 40-odd years has gone, a sense of the environment in which the Ombudsman has worked and now works as an office, and also what are the relationships with which this very special office of the Australian state is involved. Above all, what are the relationships between citizens and governments that the Ombudsman has to calibrate in many instances. So if we could begin with our history a little bit and set up a couple of things there. What we as lawyers and law students know about the Office of the Ombudsman is that it's established under Commonwealth legislation and that sets up its key functions and powers. So a couple of questions I'm interested in is, firstly, how much does that framework legislation bear upon the daily life of your office? I think it's always interesting to find out how much contracts, legislation and so forth really matter in the day-to-day of what goes on. But secondly, how has a sense of the Ombudsman's purpose evolved over time?
Sure. Well, thanks, Kristen. And can I, before answering your excellent question, just say hello to everybody. I'm absolutely delighted to be here, and thanks for giving up your lunchtime and coming into this conversation. I'm very keen for the Ombudsman and the Ombudsman's Office at the Commonwealth level. I know there's also a very excellent Victorian Ombudsman, but keen for the Ombudsman's Office to be known to the admin law community and indeed to potential people who might want to come and work for us. All the more reason that I'm not a lawyer, so all the more reason that I need excellent lawyers in my office to help with the many conundrums that come our way. In terms of your question about legislative framework and how that bears on us, it bears on us in a fundamental way every day. And a good way to perhaps start exemplifying this is this morning I caught a taxi from Melbourne Airport to the city, and the taxi driver asked me where I was from. I said, Canberra. He said, are you from government? I said, well, sort of. And he said, what do you do? I said, I'm the ombudsman. He said, ah, who do I complain to about the fact that that guy in the taxi queue who, you know, when you get off a plane and you get channeled into the right spot to get a taxi, who do I complain to? He keeps people waiting. He doesn't do this properly. Can I complain to you? I said, well, actually, probably not.
Is this Federal Airports Authority or is it? Yeah, that's quite a few steps removed.
Exactly. And so the first point is there's a whole bunch of things that fall outside of our jurisdiction that the law simply doesn't give us a role in looking at. That's one point. Second point, the law describes a whole bunch of things that are in jurisdiction. So these days, as some of you may know, my office is the ombudsman for almost the entirety of Commonwealth administration, mm-hmm. but also I have the distinct role through the legislation of being the Defence Force Ombudsman, the Immigration Ombudsman, the Law Enforcement Ombudsman at the Commonwealth level, the Private Health Insurance Ombudsman, the Postal Industry Ombudsman, the Vet Student Loan Ombudsman, the Overseas Student Ombudsman. There might be one. I'm also the ACT Ombudsman, for those of you who are concerned about the administration of the Capital Territory, which I'm sure would be close to all of your hearts. So the law determines what I look at and what I don't. The law also determines the sorts of things I can and can't do. Stuff like, well, I can investigate something, I can access records, I can access witnesses, I can access documents, I can make recommendations, but I can't make anyone do anything.
Yeah.
And therein lies in one of the core sort of conundrums of being the ombudsman. So it certainly sets out a framework. And then in terms of the second part that I and my staff think about constantly, and then in terms of the second part of your question, how has it sort of evolved over time? In some ways, our work, I think, has evolved in a way that sort of goes beyond how the legislation was originally intended. And perhaps we'll come to that, but I'll just sort of park that there for the moment.
Well, the number of functions you now have could be... There's two ways to look at that. It could be that, I mean, government's always been big during the life of the ombudsman. Yeah. So it's not like there wasn't a defence force. There probably wasn't a private health insurance at the same level. But there was the entities that you are now within your remit were around in some other way. So that massive expansion of jurisdiction, does this reflect like a growing acceptance, normalisation, faith in the ombudsman as an institution over time, such that these expansion of functions come to the ombudsman as a reliable institution that people have confidence in to do a certain kind of function? Or is the ombudsman being asked to adapt itself to a whole lot of roles well beyond what the original legislation might have had in mind? I mean, that kind of dovetails with the last point that you were segueing to.
Yes. I think the answer to that is yes and no. And, so let me unpack that a bit. I think the role has certainly expanded. When I go back and look at the earlier writings about my office and the sort of early annual reports and things of that sort, it was very much around... we're going to put in place, not just the Commonwealth level, but in all the states and territories, New Zealand and elsewhere, a place where citizens can go if they're getting a lousy deal from some government entity, right? A public service, in effect. But what it didn't contemplate at that time was things like, well, what if the citizen can't know that they might want to complain because they don't know, for example, that their phone is being listened to.
Yeah.
Or that they don't know, for example, that their data is being perused in some fashion. And so over time, one of the reasons the role has expanded in functionality is that governments have said, when we implement a telecommunications interception regime or a surveillance devices regime, or just before Christmas, a new encryption regime, when we do that, we better make sure that we put in place some safeguards to ensure that someone is checking that the way in which law enforcement agencies use those powers is in accordance with the law. I don't think that was big in the thinking of the original designers of the function in,
right.
in Australia. And then a second way in which things have moved, I think, is the nature of what we do. When the legislation was first crafted, and it still essentially says this, there's a lot more to it, but it essentially says if you complain to the Ombudsman can decide whether or not to investigate.
Yeah.
It's a sort of binary choice. You can investigate or you can't. increasingly, well, first of all, there's way more complaints than I can possibly investigate.
Yeah.
Like probably 10 times as many complaints and more complaints than ever. So more complaints than I can possibly investigate. And so I find myself asking, well, if I can't investigate them all, what can I sensibly do, which is more than just doing nothing?
Yeah.
What other options are available? And in some spots in our legislation, there is some emergent recognition of that reality. As the private health insurance ombudsman,
yeah.
for example, there is a provision in the private health insurance part of the Act that says we can mediate between private health insurers and hospitals. So sometimes a private health insurer in a negotiation with a hospital or hospital group will get into a contractual dispute that will have a bearing, if it doesn't work out, will have a bearing on consumers. And so we have a mediation role there, but we don't have a mediation role elsewhere in our
legislation. Sure.
And yet sometimes mediation or other forms of alternative dispute resolution might be a thing that I could do that is short of a deep investigation,
yes.
but more than nothing.
So when we look at that, as you say, black and white looking power or function that says you can decline to investigate for these reasons. I mean, that framework's not inconsistent with what you're saying, but there's no way that the scope of what you actually have to do is very accurately caught in that simplified get a complaint, choose to investigate or not. I mean, there are functions coming at you that require whole new skills and tools to deal with the role required. Does that suggest to you that the Act needs an update? That sort of brings us from history to the present as well as the environment. I mean, is the governmental world upon which the Ombudsman's powers bear, is it reflected adequately in that framework legislation? If we were to redesign the legislation, what would matter in that in terms of reform?
Yeah. So the first point is, I think fundamentally the Act as it stands enables us to do our job, in my mind, adequately. But if I had a drafting pen, and of course it'll be up to a parliament to determine what's the legislation. If I were the parliament, or if I had the opportunity to influence the parliament, I might well seek some adjustments to the framework. Interestingly, this gets a bit of a run. Some of you might be following the review that David Thodey is leading of the Australian Public Service at the minute, mm-hmm. which has generated a series of papers recently about aspects of Australian public administration. One of them went to the question of the integrity system.
Yeah.
Right. And we see ourselves as part of, but not the only, part of the sort of integrity framework that sits around Commonwealth administration. And it talked about the potentiality of creating an integrity commission, like an ICAC, the type body,
yep.
A matter which, of course, has been subject to a lot of political debate. And in that context, it floated the Ombudsman as being potentially a, in an Ansold paper that was put out with the recent material, floated notions of the Ombudsman being an officer of the Parliament, which we are not currently. The Victorian Ombudsman here is, and the Ombudsman probably in what people would think of as best practice international jurisdictions, the Ombudsman is an officer of the Parliament rather than appointment of the executive. So things of that ilk, plus things around the sorts of tools that might be most useful in a complex, messy environment, might be the sort of things that I could imagine the legislation being adjusted to
do that.
Yeah, and that's the kind of conversation that I envisage having with an incoming government after the next election, whoever that might be.
Right. So there is a sense in which the time is ripe for resetting the frame. I mean, it's four decades on. As you say, it's nothing in there is necessarily inconsistent with the things you have to do now, but there could be ways of specifying that more clearly. It's also part of your own legitimacy as an institution to have legislation that does reflect what it is in fact you're doing out there in the world in a way that varies that. That segues nicely to these questions of the environment in which the Ombudsman's work has to operate. There's no question that the style of government power, the style of government administration has changed radically in the four and a bit decades since the office was established. From the point of view of your office, as... That's an interesting sound, isn't it? Sounds like a drone.
Is that one of our microphones? No? Okay.
No, and it's not a drone. I can't see the drone. yeah, speaking of surveillance, we're going to get to a bit more of that. Is government, from the you receive complaints, and in order to navigate that complaint, you have to be able to map the landscape in which that problem arose. And you said before that we've got massive numbers, escalating numbers of complaints across a whole range of functions. So that could be because there's more of us these days than there were before, or it could be because things are getting increasingly complex and there are some real points of disconnect. From the point of view of your office coming into these things, is government still a recognisable thing? Do you have to go searching for what looks like governing and government? How is that story? What does that story look like from your point of view?
I think government is still a recognisable thing. At least I think I can recognise what the government is.
Okay.
You would probably hope that that is so. but I think I can see. Well, I can certainly see who the elected government is and the legislature and so on. Things do get a bit blurry out on the far edges of service delivery. I can imagine that when... And I don't know this encyclopedically, but my general understanding would be that when the Ombudsman was put in place 40 years ago, most government service delivery was done by public servants.
Yeah.
Right? So thinking about the Commonwealth, what was a great institution that was well and truly in place in 1976, 77, maybe the CES springs to mind.
For the youngsters, that's the Commonwealth Employment Service.
Commonwealth Employment Service, that's right. You used to go there to get a job.
Yeah.
So the pre-runner of Centrelink would send you to the CES and you had to go there and apply for jobs in order to get your benefit, which is, funnily enough, not so very different to what happens today.
Mm.
But, of course, different service delivery construct. So what became the Job Network is now Job Active, I think, is covered by our jurisdiction. But then a number of those providers, whether it's in employment services, disability services, the NDIS, a variety of different places, then subcontract other things to training providers, all sorts of entities. So you do get into this question of, well, where's the jurisdiction begin and end, and what does my entity do versus other entities? To whom do I send folks? And how do I help regular human beings trying to navigate these systems where to go? So something that we put a fair bit of effort into, and I know this is very true also, I'm sure, of the Victorian Ombudsman and most of the other Ombudsman institutions that are around the various systems. We try to help people enter no wrong door, if I can put it that way.
Yeah.
We try to help people. If they ring us and their issue is really about Telstra, we'll say, well, this is how you can make contact with, if not Telstra itself, with the telecommunications industry ombudsman, and we can put you through to them. Or this is how you can get to some other ombudsman. There's a number of us around the traps. So that gets a bit out on those. Of course, in 1976, Telstra were public servants, I think.
Yeah.
Unless I'm going.
So in terms of the way that the office has to be designed then, you need really specialist... People working with you need to have really specialist knowledge in how these entities work, because when a complaint is brought in, that might be the first time in some instances where you are exposing what the landscape actually is. But to assist people to navigate this, people in your office actually really need to know their way around the design of the telecommunications industry, have to keep abreast of developments in their own changes that would affect how a citizen would interact with them. So I guess some of that is revealed in complaints and investigations processes, and some of it, I suspect, is preemptive in that you need your staff to have real knowledge of the landscape in which the decisions are made and the power is exercised, so that you can help the citizen to not open the wrong door, so to speak. An Auditor General can follow the dollar. You've got a different...
Yeah, that's right.
You can recognise government as the Auditor General because you just keep seeing where did the money go.
Yeah.
It's a different thing for the Ombudsman.
That's right. Yes, and I am fortunate, and I don't take particular credit for this because I've only been there a couple of years, but I'm fortunate to have a group of staff who really, really are experts in the different chunks of activity that we have responsibility for. Things like, and things that are, for those of you contemplating a career in our fine organisation, things that are not just desk-bound jobs wading through reports, but for example, immigration detention inspection. So we go out and have done for quite a number of years ever since. For those of you with an interest and a history in the sort of immigration debate in Australia, ever since the Cornelia Rao Alvarez reports back 10 or 12 years ago, where certain individuals were either wrongfully detained or wrongfully deported, we have had an oversight role with respect to inspecting immigration detention facilities. And I have a team who are really deep subject matter experts in the way in which that works and what might be done to assist individuals navigate their way through that system. And that is also being... We're also getting a life in that regard with respect to the implementation of OPCAT, the Optional Protocol Release.
Yeah, I was wanting to get to a little bit more of that because if you think about... again, the function of the office is investigating complaints on matters of administration and so forth. This is a significant, very positive blowout from that idea. I mean, you've got inspection roles that are not complaints-driven, although they may have been triggered by an initial investigation around a complaint such as wrongful detention and so forth. You've got assistance in implementing Australian treaty obligations insofar of doing the OPCAT. I'm happy if you want to move to explain a little bit more about those aspects because I think it gives us a sense of how the office has had to adapt to a much broader environment of governmental design and government power. So if you want to head towards a bit more on the immigration side of things or the OPCAT side of things.
Yeah, well,
because it's an unorthodox role for the Ombudsman. It could have been taken by some other entity, but it's taken by you.
Indeed. And it's new in some of it's well-established territory, but some of it's new. And so we've been inspecting Australian immigration detention facilities for years and providing recommendations back to the relevant authorities and reporting on what we do in our annual reports and so on. We've been doing that activity for many years. But the OPCAT piece is...
Which is the Optional Protocol on the Convention Against Torture.
Yeah, and other cruel, inhuman and degrading treatment and so forth, which Australia signed up to a little over 2 years at the back end of 2017, back end of 2017, and the Australian government nominated us to be the what's called the National Preventive Mechanism Coordinator, which is UN language for, in effect, the entity that makes sure that Australia, well, that seeks to coordinate activity across Australia to ensure that we, having signed up to this protocol, actually do the thing that the protocol says. As a country, we're going to do, which is put in place independent mechanisms for inspection of detention facilities against a series of parameters that OPCAT sets out. But this is really new territory for us because we won't be doing all the inspections. Most, as people in a state will realise, most places of detention are not Commonwealth places of detention. They are state places of detention, jails, juvenile justice facilities, psychiatric facilities, etc. With respect to them, the emergent expectation is that inspections of those places will be done by state inspecting bodies.
Right.
But we will play some kind of coordinating role to drive that in some way, to seek to ensure that there is a coherent, consistent national approach to this to ensure that there is a means to report nationally about what's going on. And so it takes me and my office into a Commonwealth-state relations space that we have not hitherto occupied and all of the potential challenges and opportunities that brings.
Yeah, it's similar to the space of public and private service provision, as in because the border regions of how things are done is where you invariably have to do the role. And if the role is to be understood, like if I'm thinking about your corporate plan, which I've had a good look at, for this particular period, you describe the purpose of the office in terms of assurance and influence. And I guess by simplifying it in those two relationships. One is assurance to the Australian people that government entities are operating the way that they are intended to operate and they're doing so fairly and so forth. That's relationship in that direction. In the other direction of influence is to be able to provide that assurance because you are close to and influencing the quality of what's going on within the entities themselves. If you keep your eye on those two purposes and the relationships they serve, I dare say that enables you to adapt to these constantly changing landscapes and functions that come your way. You can just say, hang on, who am I and what do I do? And if it's distilled to that, you can see how your role plays across.
Indeed.
So in the OPCAT case, it's like, well, we do, we might have been triggered by complaints traditionally, but we look at how things work, we make suggestions for how to fix it, we go back and find out whether it's being done, we keep an eye on that. All of that is quite compatible with what's being asked to do, you're being asked to do in the OPCAT situation, even though if you were to read the Ombudsman Act, none of that would necessarily be apparent.
That's right. You would actually now find a reg that refers to OPCAT.
But
only if you notice the regs that were made about a week before Parliament was prorogued. Excellent opportunity to use the word prorogued. And can I just also congratulate you on reading the corporate plan?
Oh, yes, you see, I'm across the corporate plan completely.
But you touch on a couple of really, I think, really important conundrums or paradoxes in a way. The original Act doesn't talk about assurance and influence.
No, it doesn't.
But
your powers on matters of administration.
Right. We can investigate a complaint.
Yeah.
But what's the good of investigating the complaint if, at the end of doing so, you can't feel you have some confidence that what you think should be fixed or changed,
yeah,
if anything, as a result of investigating that complaint, might actually be acted upon. And similarly, and the assurance piece particularly goes to those topic areas, a couple of which I touched on before, where there is no complainant, there is activity carried on by an instrument of the state where we have a role to check,
yeah,
that what they are doing is being done in accordance with the law. That's where our assurance role really,
yeah,
comes in. Then the other thing that I've, slightly different point but relevant, is another area where we have become, we've been active for many years, but where we have to think carefully is, if you have a whole pile of complaints, indeed we have record numbers of complaints, and you can't investigate anything but a minority of them, then going to the question of, well, what can you do with them? One of the things you can do with them is you can seek to identify themes in them,
yeah,
and seek to identify topics that might be amenable to a deeper investigation. And so hence, an example of that in the recent past has been some work we've done in the relation to the National Disability Insurance Scheme, where, as many of you would know, the NDIS, massive change to service delivery arrangements for people with disability in Australia. Incredibly ambitious rollout timeframe, huge program, huge change. And there's an imperative to roll it out as quickly as can be done. The governments, state and federal governments, have agreed to a timetable to roll this thing out and get people with disability onto an NDIS plan. However, the speed with which plans were being rolled out has meant that some people with a plan are unhappy with the plan and they want their plan to be reviewed, but they were getting into a long queue, get reviewed, in part because so much effort and resource was going into getting people a plan. So if you've got a plan but you're not happy with the plan, you want it reviewed, then there's been this queue formed. And people were complaining to us. So we were getting a whole bunch of complaints, and we still do, a whole bunch of complaints about this question of, I've got a plan but I'm not happy with the plan, I want it to be reviewed. So instead of trying to investigate every single complaint, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them, we undertook an investigation into the way in which the reviews were being conducted and the construct that gave rise to the reviews being needed.
Yeah.
And wrote a report about that, which we prepared, in close engagement with the NDIA, produced a report, published a report, made a series of recommendations. They accepted the recommendations, and now we can go back and seek to ensure that they have in, they are in fact implementing the recommendations to hopefully in that area of the scheme improve its administration. Yes. So hence the goal of I tell that story because I think it illustrates how we seek to achieve influence even if we can't investigate every single complaint.
That's right, and it actually also opens up a question about how over the life of the office this may have increased, which is, you know, government design is an experiment. You've got new problems, you've got new technologies, you've got new policy priorities, you've got new meta frameworks like new public management and other things that might bear upon this as well. And that governing is always experimental as we design our way into how to handle certain problems. I'm hearing from you that whether or not this was always envisaged for the Ombudsman, it certainly seems to be the case now that in that mediating or calibrating or even informing role that you have is a very important contribution to the experiment of government, because you're the one finding out what's not working. You're the conduit through which you're working out how to respond to a problem, which is itself often the product not of necessarily of incompetence, might be sometimes, but a product of trying something new. Working out that the NDIS plan, there needs to be some flexibility about little adjustments that the carer can make without the review. I mean, I don't know what it might be, but that you're exposing where the experiment needs some tinkering, and so you become intentionally or otherwise a very important part of the regulatory design system.
But we're not a regulator.
But you're not a regulator. That's
right. Yeah. And so whilst a regulator might, so if you followed the Banking Royal Commission, the regulators came under a certain amount of criticism at different points, as people would be aware, because they were perceived not to have gone hard enough to take to task those they were regulating. And sometimes that criticism is directed at us, and we have to weigh that up very carefully. But on the other hand, we don't regulate, we seek to influence. And so how we do that is the sort of the nub of the issue. And it comes up in topics, again, I imagine people in the room will be aware of the data matching issue that arose around Centrelink debts, so-called robo-debt issue, it continues to run as an issue and is indeed a matter that's before the courts now. So I don't want to comment too much on that for that reason. But back a couple of years ago when that issue took off, it was actually just before I joined the office, but my immediate predecessors did a report that looked at the fairness with which, the administrative fairness with which that arrangement was being applied, and identified a whole series of improvements that could have been made to how that thing was being done. There is a question that is before the courts about aspects of that, which I'm not going to go to, but we looked at was the way it was being done administratively reasonable. And we made a whole series of recommendations which Centrelink accepted to improve the way in which it was explained to people. So people knew that if they haven't reported their income, and that they had a duty to do so if they had income, if they hadn't reported their income while they were in receipt of Centrelink benefits, that what Centrelink might do is pick up data they get from tax to identify what their income might have been and derive a debt from that if they didn't otherwise engage with the process. And we said, well, if you're going to do that, you've got to explain that might, in certain circumstances, create the wrong number. And you've got to give people an opportunity. You've got to, you know, help them through this process in some way. They took on board those recommendations, and we have recently done a sort of second look at that and made some further suggestions for improvement. But it goes to the sort of thing you're saying. That example often gets thrown up as an example. It's not actually artificial intelligence as such, but it's an example of this data matching thing and this using big data to achieve a program effect. And I think the work we did in that space does have lessons for how entities do that.
Yes.
And how they communicate what they're doing, how they plan what they're doing, how they roll out what they're doing and the like.
Yes.
Yeah.
Before we go to questions, because we're among a lawyer, we're in a law school and among a lawyer audience to some extent, law enforcement and particularly covert law enforcement. You mentioned before about surveillance and functions that the Ombudsman has been given to basically be an intermediary of sorts between surveillance and those that it's affected, given that people who are affected by surveillance by definition don't know. So how did that role come to pass and what does it involve?
Well, the role came to pass and it continues to grow. The role came to pass in the context that the Parliament recognised some years ago that if you're going to give law enforcement agencies powers to do things that citizens don't know about, there needs to be some checks and balances in the system to ensure that that is appropriately done, lawfully done.
Yep.
The way that has evolved in the office over a number of years, and it continues to evolve, is that in a world where governments and parliaments and I suppose the rest of us, when you think about Christchurch and Colombo and all the rest, there is this focus on organised crime, on terrorism, on national security and so on. And the agencies that are trying to keep on top of that seek, particularly as technology changes, seek to gain more powers to from their perspective, protect the community. And parliaments have, certainly at the federal level, have incrementally over a number of years bolted on more and more powers and provisions that law enforcement and indeed intelligence agencies can deploy to fulfil their goals. That means every time new powers are provided, there is an issue about how do we make sure as a society that those powers are being appropriately applied. And so I should make one quick distinction. We have a role with respect to law enforcement, but not to intelligence. So there is a different entity called the Inspector General of Intelligence and Security, IGIS, who has a very specialised role with respect to fulfilling the sort of function I'm describing with respect to the intelligence agencies. I don't play in that space. If I did, I couldn't tell you.
But we wouldn't have even known who you are. No, that's not true.
But on the law enforcement space, at the federal level, what I do, and I have a team of people, some of whom are based here in Melbourne, they get out and they visit the AFP, the Border Force, the ACIC, and state law enforcement bodies where they are allowed to use federal powers.
Yep.
State law enforcement bodies, mm-hmm. and we physically inspect systems and documents to ensure that take an example, you've had your phone listened to,
yep.
And there's for the period 1st of January to 31st of January this year, was there a warrant? Was that warrant given by an appropriate member of a court or a tribunal? Is it all there? Is the reason for the warrant all recorded and clearly articulated? Is the warrant being used in the way that was intended? Did the listening to your phone stop on the 31st of January, or did it continue? If it continued, what happened to the records that were created? Were they disposed of, or what have you? And so on. So there's a whole series of requirements that the law puts in place in all of these different regimes that say what it is the law enforcement bodies do, and we go through in audit forensic kind of detail and test that is so, for certainly a reliable sample of those records. And then we write reports and make recommendations. The reports get tabled either directly with the Parliament or through relevant ministers with the Parliament in various forms, the Federal Parliament. And we also make recommendations and see the response of the relevant law enforcement agency. And generally speaking, in this space, our recommendations are accepted.
Right. Interesting distinction, of course, between reporting and inspecting. Yeah. Reporting requiring that you tell your own story and inspecting that someone else rolls up and...
Yeah, that's right. And we do a bit of both. We encourage the agencies we inspect to self-disclose if they've made an error, and sometimes they do. A notable case a couple of years ago.
And the culture of inspection would actually encourage that, because, that's, I mean, right, you're going to find me out anyway. Yeah. So yeah, I might as well be cooperative about
that's
this.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
So there was an AFP metadata, a journalist's metadata was accessed inappropriately by the AFP a couple of years ago, and they identified that and they reported it to us, yep, and then we went in, did an inspection, wrote a report.
Excellent. I'm going to turn over to questions. So if I especially could encourage students present to ask any questions. We've got about a quarter of an hour. Yes, please.
Hello.
Colleagues and other departments to agree with you to actually just make the change that way. So I was wondering, since you've had a career as a public servant, you must have a very large network of people that you know in Canberra. I was wondering if you think that your experience in the public service and that network means that, you know, you can use more.
Yeah. Look, great question, and I think the short answer is yes. Often, I think, and I think this is true of most of the ombudsmen around the country, a lot of our best work is done in a way that is sort of behind the scenes, but in the knowledge of all participants that if we don't achieve influence, we do have powers to report and to gather evidence or whatever. And it's contingent on, and we didn't kind of go to this in great depth in our conversation, but it goes to this issue of relationships.
Yeah.
If you don't, if the tightrope you're on, the tightrope I am on every single day, is how do I seek to maintain credibility and, if you will, a sort of gravitas within the system and an ability to influence the system, but still call things out in a way that might be prickly for people. And one way in which that can be done is sometimes to do it respectfully and behind the scenes. Something I talk to my staff about a lot is, let's use the levels here. You know, if you're a relatively junior person in my office and you've spotted something, take that up with the people in the Department of Human Services or Defence or wherever it might be, and see whether you can get them to recognise an issue and work out whether it is an issue, you know. And if you're getting nowhere, if you're getting resistance or if you're getting pushback, then escalate it up through the levels of our organisation and ultimately to me. And so sometimes the value add, others would be a better judge than I am, right? But the value add I seek to add is, you know, a phone call to a departmental secretary or a visit to a minister's office about, hey, we've spotted this problem, what might you do?
Yeah. Yes.
Two questions.
Yeah.
The first one is related to your recommendation-making role, and you've answered some of it, but the effectiveness of the recommendation role, and I ask that question in the context that I ran a Victorian Public Service grievance process internally, and the only outcome was a recommendation to the Secretary of the Department, and the potential to name them in the Government Gazette if they didn't comply. Now, never, ever had non-compliance because secretaries then didn't want to be named the Government Gazette or identified in an annual report or so on. So I just wonder, you know, whether you've had a similar sort of approach with your recommendations.
Yep.
So that's the first question.
Yep.
And the second one is following on from Professor Rundle's question to you about changing the legislation. My question is, does the legislation actually hamper you in your role? Yes, there might be ways of clarifying certain things, but I'm very wary of hands-on legislation, making it so complex that individuals and citizens who look up the legislation can't understand how to use it or what to do. And I prefer simpler legislation. And I like a lot more legislation rather than being made like the Income Tax Assessment Act and Conciliation Arbitration Act or now employee, but, you know. I'd like you to comment on both of those.
Yeah, sure. Great. Okay, so recommendations first. Look, most of the recommendations we make are accepted and we seek to achieve that goal, partly by influencing in the way that the woman up the back mentioned, and partly by making recommendations that can actually be actioned. You know, you can feel great about making screaming recommendations that... Yeah, that's right, exactly. So so you've got to find that balance too. Most of our recommendations are accepted.
Examples where they haven't been accepted and what...
There are, there are a number of instances where we publish. In fact, there have been in the last 12 months reports that we've published where we've said, here's our recommendations, here's the agency's response. We made 10 recommendations, they accepted 8. This is what they say, this is what we say. And it goes on the public record and people can form their own judgments. But most of the time, our recs are accepted. And increasingly, and this is where all ombudsmen seek to learn from each other, increasingly we are seeking to get on the same page as what Deborah Glass does here in Victoria, the Victorian Ombudsman, and get into a routine of regularly going back and asking the question, well, did those recommendations we made 2 years ago actually get implemented?
Yeah.
And did they have the effect? Yeah. Even if they had been, did they have the effect that we wanted to see? Because things move, you know, and what seemed like the right suggestion might need a little tweak 2 years later and so on. So
compliance for 1 week does not mean that the problem is solved. Your exchange here is making me very aware of the point we were talking about earlier about having the expertise in-house to really understand the landscapes you're working with, because you don't want to make naive recommendations, you don't want to make impossible to achieve recommendations. So the ones that you make, you can do that publishing function partly because you know it was possible to make the change, and then you've got enough sense of what could have been possible that it wasn't that you were asking the untenable from.
In many ways, a recommendation shouldn't be, it should be acknowledged that it shouldn't be a surprise because you've been through that process.
That's right. Yeah, but don't get me wrong. There are some recommendations that don't get accepted. I mean, we make recommendations which make their way under the public record about immigration detention. People, we have a particular statutory role around people who have been detained for more than 2 years.
Right.
We look at those. We go through every single case, and there are instances where we make recommendations that basically say, look, can you look at finding a way to let individual X out? And sometimes that gets up, and sometimes it doesn't. And that in the end. Can be a ministerial decision. But anyway, that's the answer to the first part. Second part around...
legislation.
And it being an impediment. Look,
legislation and actually what you
sometimes, I have excellent lawyers, but other public service agencies have excellent lawyers, and sometimes other public service lawyers argue with my lawyers that, oh, look, you don't actually have the power to get this, or you don't have the power to investigate that, or you don't have the jurisdiction to do something else, or things of that ilk. So that can occur. I don't think that is an impenetrable problem. I think we can usually work our way through it. Although, as I mentioned, if we had a bit more, if we were writing it again, a bit more flex around the sorts of interventions we performed or had at our disposal, that might help us a bit. And that's the sort of conversation I want to have into the future with future ministers and parliaments. There was a gentleman over here in his hand up.
I know, we've got actually a couple more in the head of the
queue.
Gentleman here with the blue shirt, and then we have someone at the back there as well. And I'd love a last one from students as well.
Okay. Look, I've been a whistleblower and advocate of whistleblowing for about 30 years. Just three quick points. The first two set of inquiries in 94, 95. 94 inquiry recommended a whistleblowing advisory board, and I don't think it was ever established, and which would include whistleblowers, and I would think that's a thing that still should happen. Second point, I've had a lot of experience in the university sector, the higher education. My comment there would be that different sort of complaints go to different agencies. If you've got an administrative law complaint, it goes to the visitor, which is normally unsuccessful. If you've got a complaint about financial matters within the university, it usually goes to the Auditor General at the state level, and other complaints often go to the state ombudsman. I think it'd be very useful to have a higher education ombudsman. I heard what you said at the start about the VET and the overseas students issues, but I think it would be very helpful. And in fact, the Senate committee in 2001 recommended a separate higher education ombudsman at the national level, and that would be a clearing house for all complaints throughout the country, and it would be so that all complaints that go in various states would be cleared by that. That's the second point. The third point, since about 1996, I organised I think, one of the first national conferences on whistleblowing in 1996, which included the New South Wales Royal Commission, the forerunner to the Ethical Standards Department of the Victorian Police, and so on. One of the things that came out of that conference was the need for whistleblowers to get on the front foot. And I've been advocating ever since the False Claims Act, like as they have in the United States. And I still do not understand why Australia cannot have a separate piece of legislation for whistleblowers. I know you've got a public interest disclosure agency within the Commonwealth of Hudson area. However, it would be very useful to empower whistleblowers fully through the courts. A False Claims Act, just it's the most effective whistleblowing legislation, in my view, globally, and that's recognised by most whistleblowers, why we can't have and why the Ombudsman's Office can't get behind a national False Claims Act.
We could summarise, we won't be able to deal with all of those points, so as you wish, but the overarching theme, as I understand it, is about jurisdictional gaps.
Yeah, look, I think whistleblower protection is still a work in progress. Certainly at the Commonwealth level. I'm not qualified to comment on the university piece. I really just am not expert in it. I hear what you say. I think at the federal level there's still work to be done. I'm hopeful that in the context of the live debate that is still going on about, you know, a federal integrity commission, that in the context of thinking about integrity in a broader sense, that hopefully some of the shortcomings in the federal scheme will be rectified. I might just leave it there, though, because I know that there's got a matter of a couple of minutes. Where are we going?
Then, at the very back. Thank you. Yes, you. Thank you.
Hello, Michael.
Good.
My understanding of your core role is to have a certain degree of separation from the I think some of the descriptions you gave earlier were examples of this.
Yeah, it's a really good question. We work very hard to ensure that as we pick up any new functions, that we do so in a manner that maintains our independence, our impartiality, our arm's length. But also, I have to think about, but how do I maintain the relevance of this office, and where can we fulfil the most effective function? In the vet fee help context, there are thousands and thousands of people who've got ripped off by dodgy vet providers, and they need someone to help them with their complaints, and that's what we're trying to do. I think that's a perfectly legitimate role for us to have. Query whether there should be a vet ombudsman, just like there should be a higher education ombudsman. That's another debate again. But it's a thing to watch out for. I don't think we've gone too far. But I hear the point you're making, and it's something I think about. But to me, if our independence isn't questioned, if ministers get, and they do. From my experience, if they get that they can't direct us, they can give us a statutory function, the Parliament can give us a function, but they can't direct us in the way in which we go about it, then I can maintain where we need to be. But now there was one more.
Can we squeeze in the one very quick?
I was interested in your comment about the Ombudsman's role of trying to influence government. And so I'm thinking about a situation, for example, like Nauru and the abuses that were found there, and, you know, the fact that the Ombudsman for Immigration does in fact do inspections. So I'm just wondering whether, to what extent the office sees itself as an entity that can adopt a more public-facing influence. I think as a former journalist, you appreciate how valuable that kind of information is to specific groups, or is that seen as something that might be bordering on the political?
Yeah, it's a tightrope, and we do continue to make recommendations to Home Affairs about aspects of administration in Nauru and Manus Island. But we recognise that's one area where we go in with the approval of the
Papua New Guinea and Nauruan authorities. We have to work our way very carefully through all of that, and generally that's been an area, I think it'd be fair to say, where we have judged that our most influence can be achieved outside the glare of the public spotlight. There's plenty of public spotlight on those two places, and we can try and achieve some outcomes, generally speaking, outside of that glare, but we're happy to do it.
We are actually out.
We're out.
I'm sorry to, if you've got a couple of minutes at the end as we move out, so we might be able to take some extra questions, but we are, the hour is upon us. And if you could just thank me for not only your expertise